Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we're going to do some Secure Freedom Radio. Well, it's been a wild week since Donald Trump won the presidency. The American left seems to have lost its ever-loving mind. I mean, there are actual riots in the streets over a fairly contested election. And they're not even complaining that they was robbed, or Trump cheated, or there was some actual flaw in the system. No, things worked exactly like the founders designed them. But the wrong person won, and so the entitled grievance mongers of the left have decided to throw a national tantrum. And they're smashing car windows and storefronts, and running around saying, "Trump is not my president." Well, I got news for you, kiddos. Yes, he is. Or you're no longer citizens of the United States. And I gotta admit, that's not an outcome that would make me particularly sad. All the celebrities who promised to leave, feel free. I imagine you can even get a discount rate on Trump's airplane since he just got a kind of cool new one. But the participation trophy generations and the lefty indoctrinators who have programmed them need to listen to that famous philosopher Mick Jagger, because you can't always get what you want. But instead, they are literally lying in the streets, kicking their feet and yowling at the monumental unfairness of it all. They seem angrily unaware of the actual organization of these United States as a constitutional republic. So they're baying at the moon that this is what democracy looks like. That's their tagline. Well, sadly, they're right. Pure democracy, where every person votes and we count them all and the winner rules us all, was soundly rejected by our founders because it invites mob rule. Well, that is exactly what the mob in the streets now wants. Their mob, their rule. But the very virulence and violence of these protests is why pure democracy was rejected when we formed this republic. The loudest and the most partisan drown out the rest, and we get what we have here, which is the way they want it. Well, they don't get it. We stepped away from mob rule right after we stepped away from the idea that a monarchy composed of inbred aristocrats ordained by God didn't work, among other reasons, because it's a bad idea when cousins marry. Thanks, Eddie Izzard. The Electoral College and bicameral legislature and checks and balances were all baked into the apple pie of America so we don't succumb to the occasional madness that sweeps a significant portion of the populace at any one time. It also makes sure the large states don't simply squash the small ones when a rowdy enough group with torches and pitchforks decides they want to hijack the country. Well, now that that part of the civics lesson is over, let's have a civility lesson. And we clearly need one. The mob in the street may be foaming at the mouth and incomprehensibly shrieking, but the supposed intelligentsia of the Democrats and the left is equally unhinged and squalling that anyone who supports Trump is a racist, sexist, Islamophobe, anti-Semite, and gay basher. Really? It's as if the very idea that legitimate differences of opinion exist has been lost. I support Trump, and I don't hate any of those groups. I prefer to do my disliking on a more personal basis, and on issues of substance, not mere characteristics. I'm also willing to grant the idea that those I disagree with may have good intentions, but simply different methods for achieving them that I don't think work. I don't automatically decide that they're evil because they don't agree with me or support the candidate I've decided needs to be elected. The left, on the other hand, appears to have decided the very act of supporting Trump, rather than the corrupt criminal they offered, is a disqualifier from polite society and worthy of internment in a re-education camp, which they probably had planned for Hillary's transition. It's okay for others to hold positions that you don't like and to express them out loud and at the ballot box. That's kind of the point of the First Amendment and representative democracy as a whole. Then we count on our multiple branches of government to ensure that no group can set in place policies which violate our liberties or come into unchecked power. We also count on our society as a whole to keep the freedoms of all Americans at the forefront, even the ones you don't like, and especially the speech you don't like. Speech everyone agrees on doesn't need protecting, and speech you simply disagree with doesn't give you any right to censor it, simply so you won't have to be offended. I took a look at the Constitution, and there is no right to be not offended anywhere in it. So if you want to continue to lop off large chunks of potential voters from even considering your party, then Democrats, I encourage you to continue calling the rest of us foul names and slurs rather than engaging us on the issues. See, we have legitimate concerns about the direction your team has been taking this country for the past 8 years, especially since the socialist wing of it seems to be ascendant. I mean, pardon us if it concerned us a little bit that during this election season, Bernie Sanders, representing socialism, was running at about 40%+ of the Democrat vote. I mean, that's crazy town from our perspective. And having spent 8 years watching Obama put into play policies that drive us crazy, instead of acting crazy, we voted. Okay? That's the way it works. And the fact that we had issues with Obama's programs and policies and the entire liberal progressive agenda doesn't mean they are founded in bigotry. They're founded in the reality that these policies, like Obamacare, don't work. Political correctness, identity politics, and grievance mongering are divisive and basically un-American. We're one country, not a collection of petty fiefdoms based on the same characteristics you accuse us of discriminating against. The real difference, well, one of many, but an important one, that separates the left and right is that we still believe you are an American first, not a hyphenated American with your approved victim group identity appended in front of that. No, we think that when you come to this country, or if you're born here, you have an obligation to become part of the greater good, to become part of the American dream, and that the very act of deciding your race, or sex, or national origin, or some other dividing characteristic is more important than that, is a horrible idea. Somewhere along the way, your side left Dr. Martin Luther King's dream that all should be judged on the content of their character, not the color of their skin, to create a world where the characteristics you can't change define you. And you must band together with others who share them, not set them aside, and work together with all of us blessed to live in this great land. America is the greatest country this planet has ever seen, because of the founding documents and their commitment to ensuring government never turns into mob rule. All the craziness going on in the streets and in the media right now, notwithstanding, America will continue its unended streak of the longest continual peaceful transition of power ever. So lighten up, lefties. There'll be another election in 2 years. But if you guys keep this up, you'll gain nothing. So I advise you to keep squalling, keep name-calling, keep trying to divide us, because all that's going to do is make sure that 2 years and 4 years and 6 and 8 years from now, you're kicking and screaming in the streets all over again. Meanwhile, we'll get busy rebuilding the Republic. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. We'll be right back with Sean Davis from The Federalist.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and we are joined now by Sean Davis, who is co-founder of a great publication, The Federalist, and one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter, as he points out the hypocrisy and ridiculousness of the American left. And Sean, that has been on full display as they've thrown a nationwide tantrum since Donald Trump had the audacity to, number one, win an election, and number two, not immediately recant all of the reasons he won that election and apologize to them, because they just can't believe that this has happened. So they're throwing a tantrum is the correct term, and rioting, breaking stuff, tearing it up, and basically saying he's not their president. Are they right?
Well, no, of course they're not right. Obama was my president, even though I didn't vote for him and didn't want him to win. And Donald Trump is America's president starting on January 20th. You know, it's interesting, after that third debate, when the media kind of pounced on Trump for refusing to say he'd concede the election, which he didn't actually say. He said, you know what, we've not even had the election yet, let's see what happens. So they treated that question, his response to it, as though he was taking, an axe to the fabric of democracy, a sledgehammer to the foundation of our republic. And yet here we are, a week after the election, and leftists are protesting and rioting.
And literally taking sledgehammers to people's cars.
Yes, in Chicago, a man was dragged from his car and beaten because the rioters thought he might have been a Trump voter. And so here we are in this environment after Democrats told us that Trump was basically a traitor for not accepting the results of an election that hadn't even happened yet. And yet, where are Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama? Why have they not denounced this violence against our democratically elected next president? Why have they not called for peace and calm? You know, they were real quick to come out and tell Donald Trump, the president-elect, to denounce this person and that person and that person, yet they cannot deign to denounce any of this violence that, quite honestly, is being perpetrated by people who supported either Hillary or Obama. It's shameful.
Or both. And I guess it's part of the hypocrisy. You could call it liberal privilege, but I hate to give them, you know, the idea that this concept of privilege exists, but if it does, it certainly exists in what is considered the right of the left to call the right out for one thing and then do the exact same thing with no repercussion from, as you mentioned, their political leaders or the media or any of the rest. So it falls on, well, folks like you and me to go ahead and do that. Now, is there any chance, there's also calls to have electors delegitimize this election and somehow throw it to Hillary. That seems, again, to be more liberal fantasy, because in the end, I don't know that they could actually make that happen, can they?
Well, again, it's funny. Let's go back to the rhetoric before the election actually happened. People on the left, progressives and Democrats, were just fit to be tied over Donald Trump saying anything was rigged. You're not allowed to say anything is rigged. That just really cast doubt on our democracy, and it's inappropriate and shameful. And yet here we are after the election. They're trying to say the election was rigged, the Electoral College is rigged. And now, like you said, now they apparently want to rig the Electoral College themselves after we've actually counted the votes. Like, it's too much for me. I'm not sure I can parody them.
So now the Electoral College and the very concept that Hillary may have won, and I guess did at this point, win the popular vote, delegitimizes Trump, even though the Constitution sets up the Electoral College, and apparently we're going to be teaching civics for quite a while now. And when you go to run for president, you don't run to win. You don't run a campaign to win the most popular votes. You win a campaign to win the most electoral votes. And consequently, because Trump did that quite a bit more successfully than Hillary, he's somehow demonized because he didn't win more votes. We're not a pure democracy. We're a constitutional republic. But they don't like that either.
No, and it's just so silly to me. You know, I watch college football a lot. I'm kind of obsessed with it. And this whole argument that he's not really legitimately the president because he didn't win a contest that nobody was actually waging is a lot like saying maybe Alabama didn't win that game. Maybe they're not really undefeated. Because if field goals counted more than touchdowns, then they would have lost some of those games where they got way more touchdowns than the other team got field goals. Or maybe we should count total yards and not total points scored. It's just silly. The fact of the matter is that Hillary and Trump both ran under the same ground rules for the same goal. They both wanted to win the Electoral College. They were both going towards the exact same outcome. Trump won. Hillary lost. You don't get to just go backwards in time and say, hey, let's assume the rules were different in a way that would allow Hillary to win, and then further assume that Donald Trump wouldn't have known about those rules and would have run the same campaign he ran, and so of course Hillary would win. Let's call her president-elect and move on. It's just silly, and it's kind of denial of the highest order.
Yeah, you know, and as it turns out, it really looks like the Hillary campaign was running a landslide campaign where they thought they could really run the table because she didn't campaign. She never went to the state of Wisconsin, my home state. I'm from Green Bay. And she never set foot in that state during the campaign because they assumed it was safe. They forgot about the fact that there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who hadn't been coming out to vote because the Republicans hadn't been running anybody who didn't make them slightly ill. So they ran someone that people in Wisconsin could get behind. They got behind him. And because Hillary was trying to run the table and get herself a landslide victory, she may have stepped in it.
She totally did. There was an article in the Washington Post, I think, that said Hillary ran either more ads or spent more money on ads in Omaha, Nebraska, going for the lone electoral vote there than she did in Michigan or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin. Which is just shocking to me. Why on earth would anyone do that? Yeah, it's absolute hubris. It's spiking the football before you've ever even caught the pass. I mean, she deserves what happened to her.
So, Sean, what happens now? I mean, obviously the wackadoo fever swamp left is going to continue to throw their tantrum and do what they're doing and try to secede from the country, which I don't know where. I guess California. They could have the Cal-exit? As opposed to the Brexit or the Texit. But what about the rest of them? What are the Democrats going to do now as far as becoming some sort of legitimate opposition?
Well, they can do one of two things, in my view. They can do what they did after 2004 when Kerry lost and just go, you know, pedal to the metal left. There was a lot of talk after Kerry lost in 2004 that they needed to moderate and they needed to become more of a centrist party, and they rejected that, and they picked Howard Dean to run the DNC. And you know what? It worked out well for them. They won in 2008. They won in 2012. And so they can either do that. They can moderate. They can be centrist. Or they can do what they did with Howard Dean and just pick a crazy, kooky leftist who is completely disconnected from middle America. And it looks like they're going to do that in Keith Ellison, a Muslim congressman from Minnesota.
But they've got the feel the burns. You know, they've got those people who formed 40%+ of the Democratic electorate, you know, of their legitimate voting bloc, who believe that, yeah, socialism, sure. I mean, this capitalism thing hasn't worked out so well. We should try it. You know, they believe that the Constitution is a dusty old document in the back of a building that they no longer consider relevant. So they almost have to go that way. And I just don't see how that's going to resonate with anything more than that, you know, group within their party.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Now, I don't buy into the whole permanent political majority thing. You know, people said after 2004, oh, the Republicans are going to control government forever. And then after 2008, oh, Democrats are going to control government forever. So I don't look at 2016 and see, you know, red wins as far as the eye can see. It can definitely change, but I have a difficult time seeing how electing kind of a radical guy from a district that Obama carried twice by 50 points when they just got thumped in the Rust Belt is really going to help Democrats. But maybe they've decided They need to buck up the base. They need to scrounge for every last, you know, college leftist, progressive, totalitarian voter, and they'll just leave a middle America to the Republicans. I mean, if that's their gambit, go for it.
Sean Davis, co-founder of The Federalist, thank you so much. Up next, we'll be talking with Kyle Scheidler, director of the CSP Threat Information Office.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined this segment by the Center for Security Policy's own Kyle Scheidler, director of our Threat Information Office. And Kyle, we have a threat that may be properly dealt with in either the upcoming lame duck session, or if not, almost certainly in the early days of a Trump administration. And that is our not good friends, our enemies, the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, these guys have been running rampant around the globe for a long time. They actually ran Egypt for a little while. And, you know, unbeknownst to far too many Americans, they've had an influence operation here in the United States for decades. They've done a great job infiltrating. They have a number of front groups such as CARE and the Islamic Society of North America that unfortunately get treated as if they are Muslim social welfare organizations, when in reality, they are Islamist organizations looking to push their agenda. And now we hear from one of Trump's foreign policy advisors, Waleed Faris, that they are hopeful that the legislation to designate the Muslim Brotherhood or tell the State Department to do so might pass in the lame duck, or they're asking for it to. What's your thoughts on designating the Brotherhood and basically calling one of our enemies by name?
Well, I think it's an absolute must, Jim, if we're ever going to get a handle on the global jihad movement and the threats that we currently face. Now, Waleed said that the Trump administration is definitely interested in designating the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, he can do that unilaterally. He can simply order the Secretary of State, whoever he ends up appointing, to do so. He doesn't require congressional approval to do that, and I'm hopeful that he will definitely take that step. However, I think it would send a strong signal if the U.S. Congress was to pass the designation bill in the lame duck session. It would essentially say that all three branches of the U.S. government are really behind this effort, that we really genuinely believe that this is something that needs to happen, as it does.
And for once, okay, the Republicans are going to control both houses and the presidency, and the American people have spoken, you know, quite loudly. And it's not like Trump had not telegraphed that he actually understands the Islamist threat. So like you pointed out, for the House and hopefully the Senate to go ahead and pass what's a non-binding call for the State Department to do that does take a politically thorny issue and give it the imprimatur of the U.S. Congress as well then as potentially the executive branch if Trump does this. Now, I think the difficulty lies in the need for that. And the need for that is that the Muslim Brotherhood, through these front groups, has been extremely effective at pushing a message that they're not the bad guys, that no one should be looking, you know, nothing to see here, move along, is essentially the, you know, the watch call of all of these organizations. So I think there will be a huge political backlash. Do you think the American people are far enough behind this that that can be overcome?
I think so. This has been the case for a while, that the American people really understand the threat posed by the Islamists in a way that really the leadership hasn't. I think if you talk to the average grandma in Iowa, you have a better chance of her knowing that CARE and ISNA, these groups you mentioned earlier, are tied to terror finance than if you spoke to your average staffer on Capitol Hill. That's a sad reality, but I think that's been the reality for some time. And that's been part of, I think, the surge that was behind the Trump election was a genuine understanding by large segments of the population that something was wrong in our security efforts. And so I think this is something that the American people genuinely want. And it shouldn't cause a lot of heartache for congressmen to go home and say to their constituents, yes, I voted to designate the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, where will it cause them heartache? It will cause them heartache when the Brotherhood political fronts like CARE and ISNA and the Muslim Political Affairs Council and Muslim American Society and all these groups come out and howl and whine and complain because obviously this is going to hurt them hard. But the reality is that plenty of evidence exists to designate the Muslim Brotherhood both in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East as a terrorist organization and to designate its entities here because of their roles in terror finance.
And plenty of other entities have already done this overseas, so it's not like we would be the first ones. There are other Muslim countries that have designated the Brotherhood as a terrorist group. So I think following their lead and following, as you mentioned, the common sense that these guys do not have our best interest at heart, and even the best interest of the Muslim community. They get proclaimed to be voices of the Muslim community, but what they do is they drown out the voices of anyone who disagrees with their hard line. So I think it's a bonus to be able to stop their nefarious activities and also to stop the silencing of other voices. I want to jump to a related situation. There is a campaign right now where Keith Ellison, who is a Democrat representative and a Muslim, has thrown his hat in the ring to be chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Now, Keith has problems, as we have pointed out, and you've done some stellar work in cataloging his bad connections, many of them with the very groups we're talking about that could end up, you know, being caught in this web of ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. He's spoken at their conferences. He's supported them. He's taken political contributions from them. He is pretty tainted as far as his connections with these groups, is he not?
He absolutely is, Jim, going all the way back to the very beginning of his political career. Now, Keith Ellison is a guy who, even if for a second you held off on the Muslim Brotherhood angle, he's still a very radical, very progressive Democrat. You know, you've got a guy that compared 9/11 to the Reichstag fire back in 2007, and this is who the DNC is looking at putting in as their chairman. That's pretty problematic.
Yeah, it says a lot about them.
Yes, it does. But you mentioned the ties. Yes, absolutely. Ties from CARE, ties to the Muslim American Society, which federal prosecutors said was the overt arm of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. He receives a lot of money from these organizations for his campaigns, and he in turn assists them by attending their conventions and their fundraisers and helping support them as well. He also defends them on Capitol Hill. As you know, there have been a number of really good committee hearings talking about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in infiltration, penetration of the U.S. government and their impact on our security. And Keith Ellison is one of these guys that leads the charge to defend these organizations anytime the issue is brought up, and he will besmirch and target anyone that complains about it, even other Muslims, like our friend Zudi Jasser.
Do the Democrats know this, or do they just don't care? You know, it's back to the old Soviet appellation where are you a useful idiot or are you a fellow traveler? And I think at some level there is a collection of both in the leadership of the Democrat Party. They've decided to make common cause with groups they either should know or do know are Islamist in nature. And let's clarify, that's not all Muslims, but it's a larger percentage than anyone wants to admit do believe that Islam should be supreme, even over the U.S. Constitution. That's the belief behind the scenes of these groups, and that's why they are a problem, and that's why the Brotherhood is a problem. So do the Democrats just not care, or do they care more about CARE than they do about the United States?
Well, Jim, that's a good question. And, you know, some might argue that the Democrats are looking at the Muslim vote and they're looking at groups like CARE and saying that these Brotherhood organizations can deliver the Muslim votes for the Democrats. Now, there's no real evidence that this is true. We haven't seen it in other developed democracies like Britain, where Labour Party made a similar bet that the Islamist groups could deliver the Muslim vote for them. We haven't seen that in the United States. You know, CARE had a major million-man voter registration effort, but if you look at the votes, it doesn't really seem to have been that successful. So why are they so devoted to this? I think part of it is simply a desire to double down. Having lost to Trump and Trump's rhetoric on this issue, they feel obligated to rise to this challenge, even if it's a loser for them. You know, I think the logical thing to do would have been to look at the election and say, you know, how did we fail blue-collar workers? How did we fail lower-income voters? And try to work towards that. But they haven't really done that. Instead, they've said, we want to push this social issue. We want to push these immigration issues, these security issues, because for some reason they think that's a winner for them. And I think they're mistaken.
Kyle Scheidler, director of our Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy, thank you for that cogent analysis. Up next, we will be talking with Gordon Chang. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and we're going to talk right now with Gordon Chang, who is author of The Coming Collapse of China, as well as Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He's also a columnist for The Daily Beast. Now, Gordon, there's some things going on in Hong Kong where China seems to be meddling in political protests there. And I don't know, not particularly coincidentally, but at least co-timingly, we have political protests going on here. It seems to be a lot of discord and a lot of folks unhappy with the state of politics in their countries. Why is China particularly interested in messing with Hong Kong right now?
In Hong Kong right now, there is a big localist movement, which is essentially a movement looking for Hong Kong to become free and independent of China. And localists did very well in the elections for the Legislative Council, which is like the City Council for Hong Kong. And they're trying, Beijing right now is trying to get the localist legislators out of LegCo by any excuse they can. What they are trying to do right now is use the judicial process to say that the localists can't take their seats. And two of them have now been expelled from the legislature. A lot of people don't like the localists. They account for maybe 16 to 20% of the population. But nonetheless, nobody likes China's meddling in the process to expel them from the LegCo. So this is going to be a big story because there have been protests on the streets. There have been protests in favor of the localists. There have been protests against the localists. But Beijing has essentially lost control of the situation.
Well, Gordon, China has a history of cracking down on any separatist movements, sometimes in a particularly crushing way, as Tiananmen Square showed, and obviously as the Falun Gong, oppression seems to show. Is there a chance that this might go that way if these protests continue and you know the separatists, the localists continue their opposition? And is there any meaningful chance that they might actually be able to push in that direction and create a meaningful separation for Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think that the People's Liberation Army, which is now stationed in Hong Kong, could actually move in and basically declare martial law. That has been unthinkable for a long time, but now people are actually starting to talk about that as a real possibility. In terms of whether the localists can ever really achieve their goal of a free and independent Hong Kong, if there are real problems in Beijing, they very well could be a loss of central control of places like Hong Kong, Tibet, and Xinjiang, where the Uyghurs, the Muslims, live. And so essentially we could see China's peripheral areas, at least for some time, leave the control of the People's Republic. This has happened every time there have been problems at the center. People in the margins who are not Chinese try to get themselves free, and this is going to be an important dynamic. So it's not impossible.
Gordon, we've got a new president, and I think one thing a lot of people noticed during his campaign was the word China appeared almost more than any other when he talked about foreign policy. And he placed a lot of blame on China for bad things going on. He seems to have a relatively, if not antagonistic, maybe realistic look at China as a potential opponent and legitimate opponent to the United States in many areas. What do you see as the dynamic that's likely to come into play as President Trump is inaugurated in January?
As you point out, candidate Trump talked about China many times, especially in connection with predatory and mercantilist trade practices, manipulation of currency, and the rest of it. I think we'll see a much more skeptical attitude of the administration. They're going to be, I think, tougher on trade. And, you know, people like me were very worried that Trump would break the alliances with Japan and South Korea and let the Chinese have the run of the region. That does not appear to be the case, because Trump has talked to the South Koreans especially, as well as the Japanese, reassuring them of America's commitment to defend them. So this could be a very difficult phase for Beijing as the United States starts to reassert itself in the region in ways that people in the region actually want to see. So we're hopeful that the new president will bring a new attitude towards decades of basically failed American approaches to engaging the Chinese.
Does the possibility of a President Trump putting more pressure economically on the Chinese increase the possibility that they will react more aggressively militarily?
Well, that's a possibility, of course. But the Chinese are going to act more provocatively regardless. They've got, as you point out, an economy which is in trouble, but also they've got a political system that is now showing signs of stress as Xi Jinping, the Communist Party's general secretary, the ruler of the country, tries to consolidate power, as well as breaking decades-old norms that were designed to ensure stability at the top of the Communist Party. So I think China is moving in the wrong directions, regardless of what the United States may or may not do. And I think the U.S. is going to have to confront China, largely because China is going to do things, as it's done in the last several years, that disrupt peace and stability. And so, therefore, we are going to have to act to defend our interests, the interests of our treaty partners, the interests of our friends.
One of the ways we have historically done that, which has lessened during the Obama administration, was freedom of navigation exercises and as you mentioned, supporting those that the Chinese have been kind of pushing back on. Have we heard much in the way from Trump other than, you know, he's talked big about the, as you mentioned, the economic and mercantilist problems the Chinese have been causing. But do you think there's going to be a need for also an increased U.S., if not saber-rattling, at least show of force in the region to point out to the Chinese that we do have 90,000 tons of diplomacy in the form of aircraft carriers, et cetera?
Well, there's certainly going to be a need for a more assertive U.S. posture in the region, and that's a reaction to China. The Trump administration comes in, it's a blank slate. There's been a lot of speculation as to what the new president will do. I think a lot will depend on the advisors that he picks in the China area. And of course, mostly it will depend on what the Chinese themselves do. So right now, there's a lot of uncertainty, but I think that we will probably see more freedom of navigation exercises, because we know that during the last several months, the Obama administration has tried to prevent the Navy from actually going forward with FONOPs. That I think were necessary at this particular time.
Well, Gordon, let me shift just a little bit to another Trump-China issue. You've got an interesting column, says China's building a wall. Any lessons for Trump? And we're not talking about the ancient one. We're talking about one to stop North Koreans from flooding into China, if not flooding, at least trying to escape into China, and the Chinese trying to stop that. Are there any lessons for Trump in that?
I think there is. China has been building fencing across the border with North Korea since about 2006. Now it's reinforcing it. And as well, the Chinese are doing something interesting. They're building a military base in Jilin Province, very close to the Tumen River, which forms the boundary between China and North Korea. And it looks like they're going to use the troops not only to prevent refugees from coming in, but perhaps from also advancing into North Korea if there's a failure of the regime. And so there's a lot going on in terms of China-North Korea relations. There seems to be a fair amount of tension. The North Koreans, for instance, have not allowed the Chinese to complete a bridge across the Yalu River because they're worried about the Chinese using it as an invasion route. So there's a lot to be seen. But in terms of the lesson for Trump, I think the Chinese are going more to using troops than fencing to protect themselves, because static defenses don't work. And so that is a lesson for us, at least in some respects, with regard to our border with Mexico. Situation, of course, is very different, but nonetheless, static defenses don't really work.
Thank you, Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China and Daily Beast columnist, for your cogent commentary. This is Jim Hansen, and that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.